This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. We've been making cheese in Wisconsin since before we were even a state, which may be one reason why we win so many awards for it. It's what happens when a whole state dreams in cheese. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
I'm Allison Kane, and welcome to In the Sauce, a podcast about building consumer brands from the ground up. I love doing this show because I get to interview everyone from production gurus to marketing and social media mavens, anyone who can guide me on this crazy journey. This is the story of building Haven's Kitchen sauces, but it's also the story of every growing brand because we're all in the sauce. Today, I'm speaking with Ryan Rogers, my former Target buyer. Ryan left Target after 18 years and now works at FDM Sales, working to build consumer brands as their partner and sales team. If you are an In the Sauce listener, you definitely heard me talk about Ryan. He's a wealth of knowledge about the emerging brand ecosystem, but also about how Target works and how we can best work with them. Welcome, Ryan.
Hi, thank you.
Hi.
In person.
In person. This is my first in-person podcast since December of 2019.
I definitely came to New York just for you.
Oh, you're the best. So seriously, I think you actually listen to this podcast, or you've listened to some of it.
I sure do.
I mention you probably, I don't know, every fifth episode as a buyer who, you know, I don't think we were quite ready for Target, candidly, and I just wanted to work with you, honestly.
Appreciate
and
that.
I thought you had vision and you were understanding and you just were a little different. So it's really fun just to be in person with you and just to say hey and thank you for supporting us as a really early brand. But also, I feel like it's a little, you know, having you on here is just such a gift for people who are listening who are working at brands that are either trying to make it there or in there, but not quite sure how to succeed there. So it's going to be really awesome having you just sort of like fill in some of those gaps.
Yeah, we'll try to peel the onion back a little bit.
Awesome. Before that, we're going to talk about you a little bit. So 18 years feels like a long time to be in any one job, but especially at Target. You started in 2007. How'd you get there? What was the path? What did you do? And, you know, all that.
Yeah, it was a little bit before that. I'll have to update my profile. But yeah, it was 2002. I literally started in the stores in college. I had some familiarity with Target, obviously living in the Minnesota area. Just a seasonal stock person and spent a couple years there in college working my way up and went corporate a couple years later. And literally just kind of, you know, I stumbled into food.
Yeah.
I was placed there, quote unquote. They, you know, do a lot of recruiting and they just kind of create general athletes a lot of times.
Right.
And started, you know, in like bakery or frozen and bounced around a little bit and then ended up coming over to produce.
And produce, like when people think of produce, I mean, they think of like commodity potatoes and pineapples. Is that what you were buying?
I came over on like, I was a little lower on the totem pole, but I think where we were at within Target was we were growing a lot within like the refrigerated space. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Doritos have been in all Targets for a long, long time, but refrigerated and frozen, it's literally like the last, you know, 10, 15 years they've gotten like more, you know, stores within Target. So teams started to grow and they needed more people to do things. And a lot of it was, you know, distribution through a lot of third party, and then Target was investing in their supply chain and it was growing really fast. And so coming over to produce, it was definitely in a growth mode.
Right.
You know, we're expanding to all these stores and things like that.
Were you clued in? I mean, obviously I know you weren't like in the, you know, C-suite at that point, Target, but like Target's been such an interesting store just like to watch as a human, forget about like as a, you know, CPG founder. Like, right. It's gone through a bunch of evolutions. It seems to always land on its feet, and it became kind of this place of discovery for beauty and for like skincare and stuff like that. Obviously, there was someone who was like, we should also do that for grocery. People are coming there to buy their fill in the blank. They might as well pick up their milk as well.
Yeah, I think, you know, they were doing some of that. I think Super Targets were, you know, right around 2000 or something like that. And in 2005, six, when I was coming on, I think there was, I don't know, a couple hundred Super Targets or less. And I think as the crash was happening, I think they really looked at, like, you know, how do we drive consistency into the store? And milk, eggs, and bananas do that really, really well. And so there was kind of a pivot point there, I think, you know, overall, just like, hey, like, let's do a little bit more of this. And, you know, Target's got the ability to, you know, look at a lot of data and learn a lot really, really fast, and they can make decisions pretty quickly. And then, you know, coming out of that, you know, there was a lot of growth, and that's when, like, they're doing things in Canada and some things like that. And then that kind of evolved over time too. And really, I guess, you know, to put a finer point on it would be, you know, then there was another kind of, like, 2016, 2017 through Target had a handful of different challenges and CEO changes and things like that. And really, you know, since then they've started, you know, investing more in stores, investing in omnichannel, and it really, as the pandemic hit, like, Target was really set up for success, and they're kind of, you know, I guess reaping those rewards a lot at this point.
Yeah. So when you were originally brought in to produce, what was your actual job?
Yeah. So I was doing more of kind of, I ended up on the sourcing team within the produce area. So that was definitely, like, true commodities. So I was helping source and work the supply chain for strawberries and apples and all kinds of fun fruit things.
Right.
And then I got, you know, moved over onto more of the CPG side of produce. And that's where, I don't know, love blossomed, I guess, for lack of a better phrase.
Yeah, for sure.
I benefited a lot from being in the background with working in tandem with a buyer. And we were taking a lot of meetings together. So I spent, like, 15 months kind of just, like, learning about these businesses. And then Target restructured their whole merchandising team. And they created, like, they made a lot of us who were doing sourcing into buyers. And I got put into a buyer role. Well, I had just spent, like, 15 months researching these categories and executing, but, like, taking a lot of meetings, a lot of line reviews, learning all about the business. And so when I got the reins, I was kind of ready to go. And I had kind of, you know, not really realizing it, had my own visions and wanted to make my own decisions. And that's kind of, you know, took off from there, I guess.
Yeah. And I mean, when we sort of entered the picture, when we started talking to you, it seemed like you were a little bit unusual in the sense that you
I've learned that in my, as I've left,
you know, you were willing to take risks on a brand like us, right? That candidly probably wasn't going to be, like, doing 8 units per SKU per store per week, right? Like, right off the bat. And, you know, there was some explaining to do and all of that, but you seem to have this, like you said, love of making this, like, discovery set of brands that had something to them, that were doing well in their own ways in other places. And you just kind of put them together in a set. I guess the question is, I mean, I remember, I feel like we had a discussion very early on where you brought in Miyoko's and the dairy buyer had said, like, no to Miyoko's or something. And then now they wanted them back or something like that. Like, did you kind of create this, like, catch-all for all of this, like, new weird stuff? Or were you tasked with, like, a mandate to, like, build out fresh CPG? Or, you know, how did it happen a little bit?
Yeah, I would say, I guess you kind of make your own luck in some respects, and then the stars aligned quite a bit. So we're kind of flowing all of our produce pogs, and you have a lot of perishable product in there that's going bad really fast. And then you have products that I was working in, and, like, snacks and plant-based, that have a little bit longer shelf life. And that was starting to explode and, you know, lobbying internally, gaining alignment with leadership, you just go like, hey, like, why don't you let me a run at some of this space?
Right.
And we'll see what we can do. And then dovetailing with that is my personal desire to find cool stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, ultimately, like, I had a lot of conversations with Brent, like yours, like, I just want to bring cool things into Target. Like, there's a lot of like soft lines and these other areas of the Target hearth and home and things like that, that are doing really cool things. Mm-hmm. Like I said, in a lot of meetings, like, I think the Target guests should see this. Like, we should be, you know, out front on some of this.
Right.
And, but I also had the bandwidth to dive into a lot of that product and the sales, you know, to come behind that and give me a runway.
Right.
So that helped a lot too.
So if you had to sort of take that couple of years where you were kind of given this like group, 600 stores, 700 stores or something like that to play with a little bit because they had the room.
Sure.
I'm gathering in the set. What would you say if you had to say like, I learned this, which surprised me, and, or like this was like something that made itself very evident pretty early on.
I would say the hardest part was I didn't have like a clear map of where all this space was coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And it happened over two separate years where we got a little bit 1 year, like 2018, and then we got more in like 2019 or 2020. I can't get my years mixed up, but mm-hmm. you kind of start with a little bit. And it's like, okay, I want to bring in all this stuff. I had, the vegetarian plant-based set that had like 7 SKUs of tofu. And I was like, okay, like,
it's a lot of tofu.
Like, let's add some cool stuff in here. So, you know, I brought in a bunch of things, but then you take, you know, where the space was coming from, I would only end up with like, you know, I call it 7,500 stores mm-hmm. that had like extra space to do even more stuff. Well, then you spread that across multiple points of distribution and you get, you know, you're starting to work with emerging brands, but then you're spreading them really, really thin
right.
in a refrigerated supply chain, which has its own complications. And
yep.
so that was really like the toughest part. And then, you know, I think a lot of people, you know, in your shoes are like, what's the final store count? Like, what's going on? And I spent a lot of time like, hey, like, we're reflowing all these produce pods. I'm not going to know until like 12 weeks out.
Right.
So I know you have
planning
leadership and right. planning and production to do all that stuff. But like, we got to figure out how the dust is going to settle here. And I think those were kind of challenges that kind of ran parallel with each other that made things really difficult. But
yeah.
I learned a ton, obviously.
And I think, you know, I mean, a lot of times I really try to come at this, you know, I'm not a salesperson and by training in any way. I think you become a salesperson pretty quickly as
sure.
a founder. But I think part of the thing that, you know, we heard a lot, we continue to hear a lot, and is really true, especially if you're a fresh brand, is like, if you are going in, someone is going out. Like, we kind of forget, I think, because we live in this digital age, that a grocery store has an actual square footage and an
right.
actual, like, 4-foot set, and you take up 18 inches of it.
Yeah.
And when they say they don't have room, like, they kind of mean they don't have room. Sometimes when they say they don't have room, that they mean I don't have room for you. But
sure.
for most of it, though, like, I'm sure buyers would like to take in a lot more than they actually do. They just, it's, there is a physical limitation to it, you know? And
yeah, I would say, yeah. In my shoes, I was trying to go and find what I thought was like best, you know, for plant-based, let's take plant-based specifically. I was trying to find what I thought were like best in class sets. And so shout out to like the Lazy Acres of the world. I'm like looking at their set and it's like 12 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, okay, I need to somehow, you know, pare 12 feet down to like literally 3 to 4 shelves.
Right.
So it's like, you know, they have 4 feet of like dairy alt and 4 feet of meat alt and 4 feet of fermented. It's like, okay, well,
right.
that at least gives me guardrails. Like, I can put this on, you know, I can put fermented on a shelf and I can put, you know, cheese alt or dairy
and then
alt
random
on one shelf.
Sauce somewhere.
Yeah.
And then you don't even fit anywhere.
Exactly. And then you got to find, you know, it's a bit of a catch all. And I got a lot of pushback internally. It's like, hey, there's a lot of things going on in here. And I'm
right.
like, well,
But it's the discovery shelf.
Yeah.
And I guess that's part of my second question is like, so you're taking, you know, 20 feet, you're condensing it into three.
Shelves.
Right. Exactly. Shelves. Yeah. And I would imagine there's a natural tension that occurs between velocity and kind of discovery and not cool factor, but like, you know, the thing about Target and beauty, and we talked about this early on, is like, you would go there to find something new and fun and kind of cool. And the fact that you can kind of recreate that in food protects you a lot from like all of this stuff that's happening in the grocery industry. Did you find yourself sort of defending?
All the time.
Right.
I had to have a lot of conversations around like usage occasion. So you know, the tofurkies of the world would love nothing more than for me to carry, you know, four different slices and a bunch of sausages. And, you know, if you look at their top items, it's like, yeah, that makes sense.
Right.
But you got to look at when your guest is coming and how often are they coming? You know,
how often are they coming?
Pre-pandemic, you know, it's not as much as you'd think. You know, you think about the normal person going to Target is you're going to make a detergent run, maybe one fill-in food trip. You know, you're going to go for holidays, your nephew's birthday or your kid's birthday, you know, so it's not as many as you'd think is the typical guests. We get spoiled a little bit in the Minneapolis market where Target has massive share and huge stores and they all move like crazy. Mm-hmm. I was trying to build a set that was like, hey, I might not take your top items. And I realized that like, you are like, you know, not to be over dramatic, but you're living and dying by a buyer's choices. And I'm like, hey, like I'm going to take different SKUs because when that consumer is coming to the set, I want them to be able to have a reason to buy different things for different, especially in plant-based where there's a bunch of different things that you can carry and you can cover different meals of the day or things like that. I wanted that versatility in my set. So I had to explain that a lot.
Last question before we take a break. Has that guest changed? Like has the frequency, has what they're coming to Target for, you know, like, is that different now?
I think the frequency is probably changing. Like, you know, I think the consumer was like, in the pandemic was like, I don't want to go to very many places. And Target had teed itself up nicely.
Very well for .com.
Drive up.
Yeah.
Shipped, like, you know, pick up in store, like all this different versatility. And then you take a bunch of people who had gone a few times a year and they're like, oh my God, you know,
now I can get everything in one.
I need to go in there for everything. And oh, they have this and they have this. And I think there was a lot of people who ended up doing a lot of discovery and, you know, and I'm not sure that that has necessarily slowed down.
Right.
I think it's like, you know, it's kind of given Target, you know, some tailwinds, if you will,
yeah,
for all the right reasons. So,
I mean, that's what our broker keeps telling
us. Sure.
Yeah. We get really good. Like Target is up 1,000 gazillion% this quarter. Okay. We're going to take a quick break and then we're going to come back and talk about how to be successful at Target.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. There's a reason when you think of Wisconsin, you think cheese. Cheese is a huge part of Wisconsin's history and future. In Wisconsin, the state of cheese, the tradition of cheesemaking excellence began 180 years ago, before Wisconsin was recognized as a state. Immigrants traveled to settle in this lush green hills of Wisconsin, bringing their cheesemaking traditions with them. These storied skills combined with the freshest milk available created a cheesemaking culture that is uniquely Wisconsin. Wisconsin's 1,200 cheesemakers, many of whom are third and fourth generation, continue to pass on old world traditions while adopting modern innovations in cheesemaking craftsmanship. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
I'm back with Ryan Rogers. I'm my former Target buyer, for lack of a better word.
I think I was That's what you referred to me as on a lot of your podcasts, my old target buyer or my target buyer.
I can't say my favorite buyer because I feel like other buyers might listen to this. I don't know that other buyers are listening to this, but it's really funny though, because there have been times where I was talking to other brands and then you would ping me and be like, heard the episode. And I'd be like, did I say something about my target buyer? Like sometimes I forget that people are actually listening to this, which is,
it's a great podcast.
I guess kind of interesting. Okay. So let's talk about from the beginning, because not everyone should go to Target, right? Not every brand should be in Target.
Yeah.
At least early stage. So what would you say are sort of like fundamental things that you should as a brand have in place before you even think about putting Target on your, you know, go after list?
Yeah, I think it's obviously going to vary quite a bit
by category,
but too. I think more often than not, you should probably wait. I think you got to have the funds to do it. Obviously, like Target has its own, you know, guidance on, you know, what the expectations are from, you know,
trade
and all that, those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. I think you got to think about your production. I think we could talk for quite a bit on this podcast, and we probably will talk about refrigerated supply chain.
Yeah.
Coming from produce, it's a big passion of mine. I think it's a huge, like, if you're out there listening and you're an emerging brand, if there's one thing you take away from this podcast, I would say don't forget about your supply chain, especially if you're in refrigerated. I think it's obviously, we all know, like, these are crazy times and it's outrageous, but, you know, I came across so many vendors where it was like, oh yeah, we got this great 3PL, and I was like, okay, like, I literally, you know, haul strawberries 7 days a week. Mm-hmm. Like, we know who the great 3PLs are in a lot of ways. Like, make sure that's buttoned up and you have a good handle on that, because there's going, like, it's refrigerated supply chain. Like, stuff's going to happen, you know, it's going to happen more and more, and disappointing the Targets of the world. You know, not that Target means more than other consumers, but it's just, you know, it's a bigger moment.
Funny. Our new, you know, the new you, so we were out of stock on barbecue for a couple months because of the pouch supplier. And then the pouch supplier went from, you know, 5 shifts a day to 1.5. And I mean, it just was like, adding insult to injury, basically. And of course we had a mitigation plan, and we're like this and we're like that. And we had just switched from one of the SKUs to barbecue, and then immediately we're out of stock. So now we only have 2 other SKUs on the shelf. And he was kind of like, this is nothing. He was so sanguine about it. He's like, I'm not getting like 60% of stuff from other brands, you know? And I just, it just made me nauseated just to think about it. But yes, I think that's a great, if you have to take a single takeaway, you know, I think when you're starting a company in the branded product space, you're thinking so much about that brand and about the package and about the product and about all of that. And the making sure that you have not only secondary but tertiary suppliers, and you have trucks backed up to trucks backed up to trucks. I mean, and you know, we don't go through UNFI for Target, obviously, but like, if you're in that system right now, you are basically trying to decide, am I holding my breath and hoping that they actually pick up, or am I going to eat it and like freight it myself and drop it off at a DC and hopefully they'll actually accept my truck?
Right.
I mean, it's just a nightmare. It was a nightmare before, but it's just gotten like incrementally, exponentially, I guess is the word. And yet fresh is where the innovation is, and fresh is where premium is, and fresh is where the consumer wants to be. And fresh is also what keeps people going to stores as opposed to direct to consumer, right? Like,
yeah. And I think, frankly, you know, it's a matter of time for so much of this. Like, center store is only going to get smaller, and fresh is only going to get bigger. Like, you think about the feet upon feet upon feet of like pasta sauce.
Right.
Like, I'm sure there's refrigerated fresh pasta sauces out there, but it's only a matter of time before, like, people convert more and more to that. And that all needs a place to go.
Right.
You know?
Well, that's actually a really good question, because we were in a large retailer, not to be mentioned right now, who we were in the sort of plant-based catch-all. It wasn't a great set. It was kind of where they put the stuff. They didn't know where to put the stuff. Sure. And consequently, there was a new buyer. She made the accurate and very thoughtful decision to make it basically just plant-based cheese.
Yeah.
So a bunch of brands, you know, I would say 8 to 12 of us basically have no home now. And, you know, some of them can go to meat, some of them can go to dairy, you know, sure. some of them can go to produce, some of them, whatever. But you're starting from scratch, essentially. So do you think that a set like yours that you kind of nurtured and created, is it at some point going to get sort of redistributed into other sets somehow? Or are they going to start recategorizing, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, I think in a perfect world, you cultivate all of these and then they grow into big kids and mm-hmm. then they move on to, you know, if you're talking about like, you know, they all end up like plant-based milk, right? They all end up right.
Or even like hummus. Next. I always talk about hummus. Like I always compare us to hummus in 2009.
Yeah.
Right? It's a brown goop in a tub that like buyers didn't know what to do with. Consumers had no clue what to do with. And now it's a 20-foot set in every store across America. And that's how I think of like sort of that last mile of dinner, you know, that like brands like ours, they're not that many
right
now, but there will be, you know, and we're just hoping that we kind of carve out that path a little bit. And but we don't want to be the only people on the shelf that's doing that for very much longer.
Yeah, I think a product like yours, you and I had a lot of those discussions. I think as me personally, as a buyer, I liked when the vendor came in with like a perspective on like mm-hmm. where they want to live and how they want to live in store. And, you know, maybe they went to the set and they took pictures and they mm-hmm. put their product on the shelf to see how it fit and to show the buyer where it fit. I always liked that.
Yeah. Okay. That's a great little, we did do that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's always something I recommended. Yeah. Just to, you know, kind of showcase like, here's, you know, where we think we should live and why. I think it does behoove a lot of emerging brands, especially in your, if you're in a gray area or you're kind of plant-based and you have a home, but you might be in like a little, you know, you might not be ready or your category might not be ready to move into, you know, the conventional side of things. Mm-hmm. I think it helps to have like a backup placement. So I know you and I would talk about like dressings because I was the dressings buyer. So mm-hmm. it doesn't make sense to put this in here. Where do you think, you know, and I'm not naive. You might not get a lot of those conversations with your buyer, but at least to have that as like a backup. So if something like that does happen, you have that in your back pocket. Like, okay, you know, where are the 3 or 4 other places that we are living in, you know, other meaningful stores, retailers to say like, hey, like here's, you know, the second best place you can put us and we'll support it with XYZ or whatever.
Okay. So your advice before you even get started is number one, make sure you have the money. Number two, make sure you have a, like a really nice, secure, you know, production and supply chain. Number three, I think what I'm hearing is come in with some conviction about where you belong, where you'll do well. And then in terms of putting that all in a pitch, you know, a lot of times we're not going to have a ton of data.
Sure.
So what's impressed you in a good pitch other than sort of like what you just said, that I literally had someone stand guard. I took off, I like moved all this stuff. I like put our stuff on the shelves. Sure. I took 85 pictures and then I tried to move it all back.
Yeah. I would say you're going to run into a lot of buyers at Target where like data is like table stakes.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you got to know the buyer. And I would say, you know, as a quick aside, like brokers aren't for everyone, but I think for some places like Target,
it's a
I
must.
Think brokers are crucial. And I think there's a great ecosystem of like Target specific brokers that are, you know, a lot of former Target employees or have great leadership. You know, if mm-hmm. anybody needs that guidance, feel free to reach out to me. But I think, you know, those are things that can help give you insight into what that buyer's, you know, kind of looking for and what's table stakes.
Yep.
But to answer your question, I would say, I liked the retailer slide a lot. Working with brands now, I think, you know, some people I think are like, oh, well, you know, whatever, everybody's in, you know, Sprouts and Whole Foods or a lot of brands are in there. Like I would always, you know, knowing your retailer, I would, you know, there's key peers that you're kind of looking for.
Right. Are you looking, or is there, when you see...
Oh, yeah. I loved seeing Costco and Wegmans on decks.
Okay.
I was like, because, like, I felt
if
like...
If you can handle Costco, you can handle Target.
Right? Yeah, and I felt like the guest is was very similar to Target. You know, you're going to have that consumer going to probably both of those places, mm-hmm. or really all three of those places. So, you know... I would take a lot of influence from their sets and product they carried and mm-hmm. go like, okay, well, you know, that's been, I shop at Costco. I love treasure hunting at Costco. If those guys took the time to do some due diligence on this brand that I think is interesting, like that would go a long way in my mind.
That's actually really helpful advice because Costco is a tricky one.
Sure.
Because you don't end up making really any money. I mean, you can make a little money and the top line's good and maybe you get some scale and you get some efficiencies there. But by the time you've done like the dunk, the dunk, the dunk, you know, your bottom line is like a little bit of profit, hopefully. And Wegmans is an interesting one too, because Wegmans, it's really hard. Wegmans, we've never been able to actually have a conversation with an actual buyer. It's all through our UNFI broker.
Sure.
They are very gung-ho on private label.
Yes.
And, you know, they're very clear that they really kind of want 80% of their store to be private label, and they'll take some brands. And you know, we've been in there and we've done well, thank goodness. But it's a store that carries a lot of weight with other buyers, which is kind of interesting just because it's not an account that we can do all that much in. It's an EDLP. There's no sampling. It's like the way that we did.
You sound like you're describing Target.
Well,
right.
Well, no, I mean, the way that we did really well at Wegmans was Instacart. Honestly, our sales like quintupled because we were doing Instacart ads and people weren't necessarily going into that refrigerator. We're in a really weird spot in Wegmans. They were just buying us online. And then that sort of got that flywheel going with them. And then we were able to get more distribution and more SKUs and all that. But it's an interesting, it carries a lot of weight, I think, you know,
From my perspective, I would just look at their sets. Mm-hmm. And as I was doing a lot of research, especially in the plant-based space where I felt like, okay, I needed to catch up. Mm-hmm. Those were one of the ones like, okay, like here's, you know, how I feel is best in class. Well, how is like, you know, and when I say best in class, it's usually like the natural channel, like mm-hmm. Whole Foods or, you know, Lazy Acres, as I previously mentioned. And then you kind of go down to like, okay, what does the next kind of tier and maybe more direct peer of, you know, retailers look like, you know, and how do I need to model that? So I think that's where, you know, in my mind, I was putting a lot of weight into there. And then I think from a Costco perspective, I know they're obviously very selective and it's like, okay, well, if they're being super selective and these guys got in there, like that means something in my mind. It wasn't, might not have put me over the top on a brand, but it carried some weight, especially with emerging brands. If there was something that it felt like it helped.
Costco's a fun one also. I mean, we're not in there yet, but you know, it's a fun one because it is a treasure hunt and you can create, you know, because you have that tray and you have sort of assuming you have like a 3-pack or a 4-pack or whatever it is, you have kind of more space in a way to tell your story. And you can kind of get a little bit fun because you know that you're doing this like 12-week thing, maybe twice a year. You're in, you're out. It's, you know, and but it's again, it's one of those things like you really have to be ready for it.
For
you
know?
Yeah. Okay. So is there anything else that you've seen? Have you met every, I mean, I guess this is interesting, pandemic too. Like we met twice, I think. I came and I cooked for you.
Sure did. It was delicious.
Thank you. Did you meet every single brand that you put in the set?
I think so. Yeah, I mean, at the time I definitely would have, as we, you know, if there was anything I was doing in like 2020 might not have like officially, but I was very, very passionate about line reviews.
Yeah.
I've learned as I've left Target that I, you know, might have been more unique in that space.
Like I kept telling you that. You just didn't really believe me.
I really liked building out a cool set and finding things and winning, I guess, to, when you, if you really want to put a finer point on it. So I was always taking meetings and trying to find cool things, or at least get an education about the space. And, you know, that probably comes from a lot of my produce leadership that I had, and that encouragement and things like that. And then obviously the bandwidth to be able to do that was great. So.
And then last thing we talk about before we go into actually like, okay, now you're on shelf, then what? Sure. Was there anything that you saw in a deck or in a founder or in a sales presentation that was like a red flag or like a, this is not the brand for me, like that we should avoid? Yeah.
It actually was pre-pandemic, and I won't name the brand, obviously, but I had...
Does it rhyme? No, I'm just kidding.
I had someone come in and sell me and give me a their story of how their brand came to be was based. It wasn't a political position, but it was kind of in the realm of that. And this is why they created this brand, because of this. And I was like, I thought it was really interesting, but that was like the beginning of the presentation. And I was like, I was immediately out. Like,
interesting.
Like, you know, I tried to sit on it. I tried, you know, think about it. You know, I was working with a broker on it, and I had told him immediately, like, hey, I like, this really rubs me the wrong way. I don't know that I can do this. So I tried to be like thoughtful about it and not hold it against them. But I was like, you just got to be careful, you know, what you say. I had another founder come in and, you know, was a little, I guess, like loose-lipped on some things, you know, of some personal opinions on some things. And I was like, that's, you know, it was like, okay, like that's just a little weird. And you just, you know, when you're
so keep it professional.
you would think that that's the baseline there, but you know, like everybody's got their own personality, but some of those were just like, you know, every once in a while you'd run into that.
And
I
was like,
and you know, the flip side of that is you get, you know, obviously to answer an earlier question, if you can get, you know, someone like John Foraker to invest in your business, you know, like there's always that helps a ton, but you know, there's only, you know, a small number of people like that, but.
So that's interesting. So I don't think I ever talked about my investors in any of our meetings or on my deck or anything like that, but that could be potentially something that would be interesting to a buyer. Just as like a vote of confidence.
I think it can be.
When it's too much, when it's like, these are all the amazing people that whatever, then it's
I mean, I bring up John. I mean, obviously he's very well known and very talented. I think, you know, he had a long history at Target with his time at Annie's. So when he, you know, spoke, people listened, especially leadership at Target. So that was like a very unique case. I've had a lot of vendors, you know, before and after my time that are like, what's the, you know, magic bullet here? What's the one thing I got to have that's going to just get this over the line? And I don't have an answer for you. Like, you know, Jay-Z could be an investor in your brand, and it's an interesting thing to put on a slide, but it's not necessarily going to get it done. Like ultimately, especially at a place like Target, like they're, you know, it's very practical. It's data driven, you know, like I was unique in some way where I like to find younger things and build out the set that way and try and find some, you know, things that were going to set Target up to win in the future was ultimately my goal. But yeah, it can help, but on, you know, it, depending on who it is, like it might not matter at all or to the buyer. So,
okay. So now this pretend brand has won over the Target buyer. Their deck was fantastic. Their presentation was great. They get, you know, somewhere between several hundred and a couple thousand, you know, stores. That's like, you know, I always say that is not hitting a home run. That is literally getting up to bat, right? So, you know, one of the things that we found, we were getting a lot of feedback on our Instagram, for example, from our consumers that were really excited to find us at Target, that it was like $8.99 or whatever it was in some stores. And, you know, we don't control that. And is there something that we should know about, you know, pricing? Like what happens in the pricing plan, because you're not, you know, we were like, we should be $6.99, and we are in some places, but we're really not in other places. And, you know, what's that all about?
I mean, I think, you know, it's called manufactured suggested retail for a reason.
Suggested.
It's definitely a suggestion. So right. As much as you feel like you need to be somewhere and you can build out the case any way you want, ultimately it's, you know, I guess most of the time a buyer decision. And then, you know, there's going to be places at Target where it might be, you know, a larger group of people that are looking at that stuff. Or, you know, at Target, we were always, you know, competitively shopping things. So like that mattered.
Right. Is there an understanding? I mean, I assume that there's an understanding on your part that velocities might take a little hit at a higher shelf price, and that's okay because the dollars per the slot are coming in. Or
yeah, some of that's going to be narrative. And, you know, an item like yours, in my set, I was looking at like unit turns, units per store per week was my primary goal, but you were more expensive than most things in my set. So I would pivot that dialogue internally to go like, okay, well, where's the dollar, you know, threshold for the class, and where do they rank in that? So
very, very high. We set the bar for the class. Sure, I don't know what the class is, but yeah. Okay.
But yeah, that's, and some of that is just, you know, if your buyer's not going to look at that or help you with that or give you that, help you with that narrative, you need to work on that and you need to help them see that.
That's why a broker really does play a big part in 100%. The Target ecosystem.
Right.
Anything else that you wish that we knew once we did get on shelf, like that's important that we do that we don't know that we're supposed to do?
I would say I saw the most success in the scrappiest vendors. So, you know, you and I had a lot of those discussions. You use some third party like marketing and signage firms. I think like those.
It's awesome that you let us do that.
Yeah. I think those are things where sometimes you just got to bring that to the buyer and go like, hey, this is how we want to invest and this is how we want to improve. Like there's a lot of people in this business that, you know, because you kind of grow up, you know, I don't want to oversimplify, but in theory, you grow up in that kind of distributor model of like KeHE or Unify, where everything is just a promo, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, well, you can get really creative at Target, and the best vendors get creative, whether that's with the Circle program and getting surgical. Like that was a drum I banged all the time within Target, is like the Circle app is spectacular.
Yep.
It's very surgical. It's very, you know, it's really easy to do things, you know, one-off things or short time periods. Like I think you got to break that, especially in the digital age. You got to get out of that like Sunday to Saturday mindset,
right?
And just do what's best for the brand. Like, you know, if you have a broker, push the broker to get you like, you know, out of stocks by store. And if you put a threshold in there of, you know, number of weeks out of stock and go like, okay, send a merchandiser in there. Is it just sitting in the back room?
Right.
Do you need to actually get, you know, help the team like reorder for that store or push product to those stores to get that back on shelf? Like POG integrity is not unique to Target. I think it's, you know, with any retailer, it helps to get really, really scrappy.
Yeah. No, that's super, super helpful. There was something you said, oh, Circle. It's interesting because, you know, even if you just think about like a Circle promotion, or I don't know if that's the correct word for it, but you know, something that you can do on Circle or even on any digital, right, is like someone clicking a switch, one person clicking a switch on a computer and it just goes out to every guest, as opposed to people on the ground in the store, hanging tags, sticking things on, you know, all of us have to, that is not happening anymore. It's whether it will ever happen again, I don't know, but the combination of sort of the consumer moving digital and then just labor being what it is,
100%.
It's just like a double whammy.
Yeah, you want to squeeze as much juice out of that orange, to stay with the produce analogies here. And a way to do that is just to, you know, be more surgical with the stores and the stores are in, you know, like, yeah, it's really easy to run a temporary price reduction, temporary price cut. But at the end of the day, like you have all these other tools at your disposal and you can get down to you know, maybe it's really capitalizing on your best stores and right. pushing, you know, getting those guys moving even more product, you know, like there's different
yep.
levers to pull and you should be thinking
we
about
did
that
like top 100 and bottom 100.
Exactly.
But talking about the bottom 100. So I always sort of said to the broker, I'm not sure we should be in these 50 stores. They're just consistently dragging us down compared to these other stores. Some of our stores were amazing, as always, right?
Sure.
And there's this sort of like, well, we don't want to give up door count because then it looks like maybe there's like a lack of confidence or maybe we're moving in the wrong direction. And I was kind of always like, well, I'd rather us do it than him do it.
Sure.
Right. But so is there any advice there? Like there are going to be stores within a retailer that are just not going to be a great fit. It's just not going to be that aligned.
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I think other retailers will probably have a little bit more flexibility. Target is, you know, going to segment by planogram. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times you're at a higher level when you're segmenting that. Maybe you're just breaking out by like a super target and a non-super target. So just removing 10 stores, like you can bring that to the attention of the buyer as like, hey, like, you know, we've been at this for, you know, 4 months and these aren't working. Mm-hmm. You know, we've tried this and tried that. Like, let's look at that at the next review. But, you know, it's not the worst thing. I think it shows the buyer that you're critically analyzing the business,
right.
but sometimes the ability to do anything about it
right.
is just not there.
Right.
Just by the way they break things out.
Got it.
It's not any less work to do less stores.
Right.
It's still, you know, the functionality is still all the same. It's
right.
just, you know, that kind of thing. So
the way, yeah. Okay. Before we move on to the last 2 minutes of what you're doing now, last licks, anything you just wish that you could like shout to emerging brands as they are trying to get on Target shelves or trying to stay on Target shelves? Like,
I would say it's really hard to be patient, with Target. It's a big account. It's a lot of stores. It's a great store. Obviously, you know, no knock, but everybody thinks it's the perfect match mm-hmm. for their business and or for their product. And more often than not, it is. But you need to understand, like, you know, it's not easy to do. And sometimes it's just worth planting a seed mm-hmm. with a buyer. And yeah, that buyer might turn over and you lose all your momentum, but it's okay to be patient. It's like, more often than not, Target and food is going to fast follow. So mm-hmm. like, look at the other stores and how do we increase velocities
right.
in Sprouts and Whole Foods and Kroger and all these other places so that when we go back to Target, our mm-hmm. story is even better. Look at us go. We're ready to rock is
yep.
What I would say.
Yeah, that's great advice. Okay. Last couple of minutes. What are you doing now? And what are you loving? And what are you learning? And
yeah, still in emerging brands. Mm-hmm. So I work for an external sales company that helps emerging brands grow.
And do they do all different retailers or do they specialize in certain retailers?
They do all. There's obviously a million independents, which is hard to do. Mm-hmm. So we're not a broker. We're more like just like external sales. So if you were
right.
at a point where it's like, I have a dedicated amount that I want to set aside for a salesperson or a sales team, mm-hmm. you would hire us for a similar amount.
Yep.
And we can turn on 25 people across the country
right.
for you. My position is some sales, but mostly brand management. So they would assign you to someone like me and I would help you, you know, navigate the waters of, you know, depending on where you are in your growth cycle.
Right. Like
we're going to work at from everybody who's, you know, at first production run to, you know, maybe a little bit more established that is just trying to fill in like the nooks and crannies of smaller accounts mm-hmm. because they, you know, started big with Whole Foods and, you know, Kroger or whoever, and now they just need to fill things in.
Right.
So
do you generally manage brokers on behalf of the brands? Like, are you kind of part of the like broker management piece, or since you aren't?
I mean, we would have the direct relationships that a broker would.
Right.
Obviously, in a, you know, to bring it back to Target, like there's going to be a Target broker involved there. So there's going to be a little bit, you know, there might be a second layer in there. But, you know, from my perspective, you know, as someone who at some point in time will be able to sell directly to Target, I would probably still align you with a broker anyways, because you need that day in and day out management of Target. There's a lot of other things that, you know, maybe national brokers you could go without that our team can manage internally for you, whether that's KeHE or Unify or things like that.
Right. So, I mean, there seem to be like, Publix seems to kind of require its own little thing. Kroger seems to require its own little thing. Costco for sure. Target for sure.
But we would have like direct sales reps to call on all of those guys.
That's awesome. Yeah. I mean, the sales thing, that's the question I get. I get a lot of like sort of like expletives about distribution.
Sure.
And then I get a lot of question about, I'm kind of ready, but I'm not really ready. And I don't want to hire someone for $175,000 a year who isn't going to be hands-on, who's used to having a team. Sure. And I don't know that they're going to change my culture. And, you know, so everyone's sort of, but then, you know, it's just, you kind of have to grow into it, but you have to have it to grow into it. It's just it's a tough one.
And honestly, that's why we're positioned like we are.
Right.
Is because it's for those people who are, you know, lot of companies in that point that are like, okay, I don't necessarily want to hire two people and then have them hire, you know, 12 brokers across the country or whatever that number is. Like, you can just turn us on for that price and we will, or for a similar price and we'll
go down
for you.
Something tells me you're not going to give out your cell phone number right now, but what would be the best way for a brand to find you guys?
Yeah, you can find me on LinkedIn, which I don't know if you'll put this in like some notes or something like that, but I'm happy to connect via LinkedIn.
If you do Ryan Rogers FDM, you will get you.
Got it. Yeah, right. I haven't searched myself, so.
I have.
So that's a great place start. Yeah, yes. Feel free to reach out to me on LinkedIn. Obviously, email is fine too.
Right.
And I'm happy to talk through that.
Awesome. And you can always, as you all do, you can always reach out to me and I will connect you to Ryan. Amazing. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
So great seeing you in person and being back in person. And thank you for demystifying this amazing, beautiful retailer for all of us. Liam, thank you for engineering today's show. I really appreciate it. Thanks for being in person. I have two more episodes before winter break. And we're booked all the way through the end of April with guests. So for all of you In the Sauce listeners, please do subscribe so that you can always be aware when I drop a new episode. And I just really want to thank you for listening. I'll be back next week with another episode of In the Sauce. In the Sauce is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.